Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. But you already knew that, didn't you? Enjoy the show. Two of our annual holiday specials. Justin's here.
Howdy.
And we've got a different thing this year because we've kind of done, you know, best anime that we went through the last 10 years. We've done our all-time top 10, bottom 10 anime and movies. We've done those. So our first episode, we did our top fives for the year, both in anime and in movies. And we decided to do something a little different for our second show. Justin and I are both, media hoarders and consumers, you know, mass consumers. But both of us, and I feel like a lot of people out there have this, where you've always meant to get to something, you always meant to watch it, or your friends recommend this thing to you, and you never get to it, either because secretly, either you don't really want to see that movie, or you just don't have time for it, or it's never high up on your queue, or whatever. So what we did was we recommended three anime and three movies to each other, and we had to watch them.
Yep.
You gotta
no
sit down.
Pulling out.
No pulling out. You have to sit down. You have to watch this so we can talk about it on the show. So I recommended three anime and three movies to Justin. He recommended three anime and three movies to me. And the resulting conversation is what is born of that. So we'll start this conversation with the anime that you recommended that I watch.
Right.
And I got to tell you, this was a stumper because we both have seen a lot of anime. So
it was really hard. But yeah. At the same time, I had my giant catalog of obscure shit that you hadn't seen. So
yeah, right. Exactly. Like you've seen a lot more than I have.
Yeah, you had a lot harder time of it.
I mean, you are the guy that wrote the column about obscure anime. So
yes.
Yeah. So the first thing you recommended to me was Toy. That's how it's pronounced, right?
Yeah.
Which is this? Well, you describe it.
It's an hour long one shot OVA that's pretty much pure 80s. It's about a rock band in 1987. Who is on the cusp of making it big, and they're kind of punky, and they attract punk fans and, you know, the counterculture scene. But the lead singer, who's this, you know, charismatic, good-looking guy, is being poached by the talent manager of one of the biggest idols in Japan, and also a girl that happens to be his cousin and who's trying to sleep with him. And drama ensues. And it's not really about the story. It's more about the mood of the 80s and the music scene and kind of the feeling that people get from being in a band, I think.
See, to me, it seemed like it was chiefly about mall aesthetic, 1980s mall and music video aesthetic. That is primarily what that movie is about. It is sort of an excuse to go from montage to montage of music video effects. And it is an absolute all-star list of stuff you would see in a 1980s music video. So we're talking black and white checks. We're talking very thin purple lasers. We're talking, gradient out white by a window. And there's like a pastel colored couple. And maybe there's like a close up of like a goldfish in a wine glass filled with water, and then there's like a silver sink with just a lemon next to it. Like, it's super 80s. It is. I think I said like while we were watching it, because I watched this over at your place,
right?
And I said like, if you watch this thing all the way through, does it summon physically a 1980s vintage Sam Goody? Because it's seriously what watching. It was cool. Like, I like that. I like the 80s. I love the 80s. Who doesn't love the 80s?
Right.
And that's a distillation of that aesthetic. All the characters often look like those weird clip art things you see on like nail salons. They're super from the 80s. Like, it is so 80s. And I mean, you talked about the characters and stuff, and I laughed because there were characters in this? Like, this is so clearly a visual exercise.
I could write, I consider it a character study. I could write and have done, write essays on them.
Right, I know. And I didn't see any of that. I saw, like, this is just an excuse to get to the next pop song so that they can eat pastel-colored ice cream and walk in the park.
Hey, they never eat ice cream.
Are you sure?
Pretty sure.
But it is, I think, the 80s-est thing I've ever seen.
Well, the thing is, so much of 80s in anime is like this very froofy, kind of puffy shoujo, lots of pink everywhere. And the 80s were not that for me. And so, yeah, I do absolutely adore the aesthetic of this because it is kind of, as a kid, what you pictured it was like to be a cool adult. And it's very much that distilled sense of, you know, you watched MTV and that's what it was like. You couldn't wait to go out into the world, move to New York or Los Angeles and be one of those awesome people dancing in the, you know, amorphous void against a brick background or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly MTV played a role in the aesthetics of this.
Yes, I mean, it is a very MTV piece. But at the same time, it's such a mood piece. And you know, one odd thing about it is that even though it's about a punk band, there is no punk music and you never hear the protagonist sing.
Yeah, never. There's other music playing over the montage of the band playing.
Right. And it's like a shrill woman's voice. It's, you know, 80s J-pop.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, it is really good 80s J-pop, but it's still not what there is a mismatch. And between that and the MTV visuals, I feel like it becomes not literal. It becomes a mood piece, almost a like a somewhere between a museum installation of that time period and an art film, and that the characters for me were archetypes definitely, but there's little nuances in them that play off each other in very interesting ways. For example, the cat girl who's Nia's her name's Nia, and she's like this little sister character that hangs around Toei, the protagonist, and at first, she's just this generic cat girl, and you're not sure why she's there. But she has the potential to take the piss out of any tension in the room. No matter how pretentious or posturing any character, one word from her, and they're this non-entity. Yeah. And I found that really interesting.
I guess. I just didn't see any of those character moments.
Okay.
I wasn't paying. First of all, I thought that was a boy for like most of that runtime.
Well, 87 boys haircuts on girls were the thing.
Well, so. And the complete lack of breasts, and yeah, I thought it was a boy.
Fair enough.
But I mean, just the characters are like, yeah, okay. I mean, it's only an hour long, and so much of it is spent in montage that I just didn't see that. I kind of want to see it again so I can look for the stuff that you're talking about. But on first viewing, no, I'm really glad I saw it. It is neat. As an 80s fan, yeah, it's a cool thing to see. Like, I would argue that, like, if you consider yourself, like, an 80s person, like, into the 80s, you absolutely should track this down, because it's going to blow your mind with how 80s it is. So, yeah, I mean, it's neat. I'm glad I saw it. I wouldn't wax rhapsodical about it, but, yeah, no, it's cool.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so the first thing you recommended for me was Macross 7.
Yep.
And I had never seen Macross 7, and I had been actively avoiding it, even though I had it on my pile for over a decade. When it came out, it was only a few years, or was it around the same time as Macross Plus?
It was after, but yeah.
It was slightly after Macross Plus. And Macross Plus had raised the bar so high for what people expected from that franchise, that there is no way you could watch Macross 7 and not be disappointed. I mean, first of all, it's a late 90s TV series. There's just no way it can match that animation. Mm-hmm. But also, it's stupid. Mm-hmm. It's really stupid. And yeah. It delights in how stupid it is. I don't mean that as a knock.
No, it's a dumb show, and it knows it.
Yes. In fact, at one point, and I wrote this down, I had to pause it and grab my notepad and jot this down. At one point early in the show, someone sees the protagonist doing his thing, which I'll get to in a second, and remarks, "He must really like doing stupid things." I'm like, that's the show in a nutshell.
Yep.
Protagonist Basara Miki, I have a theory that, you know, he's supposed to be this cool character, but I have a theory that he's actually slightly mentally disabled.
Mm-hmm.
you know, living in Rockstar squalor. He sees, you know, this, you know, invading, you know, alien force, you know, the, all the fighter pilots race up into shallow space to fight them off. All he wants to do, and the right thing to do in his mind, is fly up and play his rock music at the aliens.
Shoot speaker pods into their cockpits, and his robot has a guitar.
Yeah, and he's literally, like, right in the middle of his mech with his axe, just shredding and singing his rock songs.
Yep.
And
everyone responds with, "What the fuck?"
Yeah, and they make, first of all, it's bizarre because the military makes absolutely no effort to do anything about him being there, even though he's totally in the way.
Yeah, and he's fucking up their plans.
Right. Yeah. And they just kind of tolerate him being there and are really confused by why he's there.
Yeah.
The aliens, obviously, it's not doing anything. Like, the music doesn't really help.
Yeah.
And the aliens are just like, "What is this guy? I don't get this." And so are we, for that matter.
Right.
But
I think once you realize the show's supposed to be kind of funny, like, it is funny.
Right. And there is no logic in anything going on.
No. And the Mylene, the pink haired girl,
mm-hmm.
Comments on how dumb this all is. Pretty frequently.
Quite frequently.
Yeah.
That said, I mean, as this kind of meta poke fun at the idea of, you know, J-pop songs saving the universe, which is, you know, kind of the essence of the whole Macross legacy, it's kind of funny and a little bit interesting, but at the same time, there is so little going on of anything important that it's really hard to stay with. I mean, I enjoyed the episodes that I saw. I will never finish this show.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, I think the music is great. Like, the songs are really good.
I like the music. I don't love it.
It's like, it's pretty classic 90s rock.
Right.
And it's good. And they tend to play the same, like, three songs over and over and over and over and over again. But, you know, the music is good. All the openings and endings are really good. And you watched, I specifically said, hey, you got to watch episode 11, which is the one where Basara, the lead, and Mylene star in a TV remake of Do You Remember Love? Which is, that's great.
Yeah. Which, by the way, that whole thing makes just as little sense as everything else.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. You wonder why. And why? Because the people making the show thought it would be funny.
Right.
But there's a line in there where I sort of realized, oh, this show is not intended to be serious, where his agent, or I can't remember who exactly it is explaining something to him, and Basra takes nothing seriously except, I mean, he doesn't pay attention to anything unless you're talking about his music. The character is a complete kind of a dope.
Yeah, hence my thinking that he is so simple-minded, he is probably high-functioning autistic.
I think they're making fun of shallow rock stars.
Yeah, fair enough.
He thinks he's doing something really important, and really he's just kind of in the way.
I'm over-intellectualizing something with absolutely no intellect.
Yeah. Well, there's a line in there where she's explaining something to him, and she's, at the same time, is stepping on his hot dog. Like, he dropped a hot dog, and she's stepping on it. And she explains this long thing, and he's clearly, like, he's just kind of staring at her blank-eyed. She finishes the sentence, and he goes, "You're stepping on my wiener." And I'm like, wow. This show, I love it because it's just so goofy, and it wants to be goofy, and it's having fun, and I like that. And I thought it was funny enough for me to just keep watching it.
Yeah, it's fun, but it goes by on nothing but its weirdness.
Well, that's true. I mean, hey, you should get to the OVAs where Basara goes hunting for the white whale with his Zentradi Captain Ahab.
What the fuck? I do have to give it one props. I mean, it is mostly, you know, high-end 90s TV animation, but it's still 90s TV animation. It doesn't look spectacular these days.
Yeah.
However, there's this one opening shot in the opening that is done by Studio 4 Degrees,
mm-hmm.
that is all in 3D, and it looks amazing even today.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, the big pan up from the cityscape.
Yeah. No, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
No, it's not for everybody. And if you're a super diehard Macross guy that takes himself too seriously, you're not going to like it. But whatever, man. Macross 7, unfairly maligned. I love that show.
I get the appeal now, but I can understand why it went over people's heads, because it's not overt in its comedy. It's like kind of it's a simmering kind of chuckle to yourself sort of comedy.
Well, that, and it's kind of like if you're a super fan, you go, is this some kind of a joke? And the people making it are like, yeah. Yeah, it sure is. okay, so the next thing, the thing that you recommended to me was Angel Densetsu.
Yes, Legend of the Angel.
Legend of the Angel. Which I'm a little baffled that you recommended this one to me. This is about a high school student who keeps having to transfer because he has a very scary face. And he joins this new school, and he has a super scary face, and everyone thinks he's a scary guy, but he's really a nice guy.
To a fault, really.
To a fault. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the joke. It was okay, I guess. It's very slight. They're like two 20-minute episodes.
Yeah, it's a one-shot OVA that had two episodes, like packed into one release.
And so he has a scary face, and then he looks at someone, they get scared, and then he does something nice, and they interpret it as him being mean or scary, but he's not really being mean or scary. That's it.
it is one note. It reminded me a lot of Detroit Metal City.
In that the joke gets old pretty quick too. Like, I was kind of done with it after the first episode. I got about halfway through the second one and said, okay, I think that's all there is to this.
That's all there is.
So
I went ahead and read more of the manga. It was a Shonen Jump manga that went on for a really long time, and it does lose steam. Like, they introduce new, you know, teachers that are there to try to stop him. It shows his parents, which are just as scary as he is. Mm-hmm. I found the central joke and the way it kept topping itself to be really laugh out loud funny, to the point where I'm like, I can't remember the last time an anime made me laugh this hard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess because I says, oh, wait, is that all there is to this? And then that was it. I didn't really respond to it that much. It's kind of a neat gag, and his face is really scary.
Yeah. And it makes no bones about it. It scares birds away in the park.
Right. Yeah. But so I guess that's why you recommended that, just because it made you laugh, which is cool. That's a great reason to recommend something.
You like good comedy. I like good comedy. Hey.
Yeah. All right. I didn't know it was going to be that. Normally when you recommend stuff to me, it's really heavy. So this was a little strange.
What else I recommended to you.
Yeah.
Come on. I had to spice it up. I mean, literally everything else I sent to you was just like this dour, depressing, oh, the world is a terrible place sort of show.
Man. So. Yeah. I mean, last night my viewing was Match Factory Girl, followed by Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny, followed by We Need to Talk About Kevin. So.
Holy shit. How are you not on suicide watch?
Well, Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny is pretty phenomenal.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
But anyway. So
you're... Are we done with that one?
I mean, is there more to say about it? I don't think so. Okay. So next up?
All right. So the next thing you recommended for me was the Kimagure Orange Road movie, I Want to Return to That Day.
Yes, which I will admit have not seen in quite a while, but I remember it being seeming like something that you might like. Because I know you're not a Kimagure Orange Road guy.
No. And were you?
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I know so many old-timers that loved that show. And right. We should probably recap because a lot of our audience are not old-timers.
Yeah, don't know what it is.
Kimagure Orange Road was a 1986 show. You know, the big puffy 80s look. Character design is almost indistinguishable from Ranma One Half.
Akemi Takada's watercolors. That's pretty much what that show is, yeah.
And it was a supernatural romance comedy that was in Shonen Jump that basically had this guy and his two sisters moving to a new town, and him pretty much immediately finding two girls, the hot bad girl, Madoka, and Hikaru, this clingy, annoying girl who was just kind of always there. And he couldn't decide, and it really didn't take its premise very seriously. And the reason I never got all that into it is because it never went anywhere. The characters didn't really grow in any significant way. It just kind of was the same joke. Oh, Kyosuke can't decide. Kyosuke is this kind of lame guy who is, you know, typical anime romance protagonist.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know that back then. And it didn't really do anything. So I'm like, okay, well, this is a nice little comedy, but whatever. So then this movie comes along, and a lot of Orange Road fans hate it because it all the things that they loved about the original show, the likability of the characters, the, you know, inability for Kyosuke to decide, and just kind of the interplay and the, like, little farce comedy that happens between all these teenagers, throws all that out the window in the interest of pure angst.
Yep.
And so basically you have more or less a whole movie of Kyosuke studying for finals. Hikaru is a year behind him and Madoka, so she doesn't have to study as much. And it is a whole movie of him blowing her off and trying to... It's like the end of Born Free, where he's trying to lead her out to pasture and she just won't go.
Yeah, right, exactly. Take her out back by the barn. Yeah.
Right. I have a lot of problems with this movie. I mean, I appreciate it, but it's flawed.
Well, very deeply. Yeah, no shit. But, I mean, I think part of the reason I recommended it was because it's just angst and pastels.
Is that what I have to use that?
80s angst and pastels. That screams Justin to me.
Fair enough.
But you're right. And, you know, the shot in that movie that sticks out in my head, I think is from the end, where he's on his he's finally ditched Hikaru and he's on his motorcycle. And Madoka is being her usual obnoxious, aloof self. Mm-hmm. And, like, won't commit to him or won't... Like, she really won't tell him that she wants to be with him, right?
I think they finally get to that at the end.
They finally get to that, yeah. I think that's probably why people didn't like it. Because not only did this show start out as a comedy, like, it starts out also with, like, he's an ESP-er. Like, he's psychic and has telekinesis powers or whatever. They ditched that.
Yeah, you'd never know it from this movie.
No, you would never know it. Like... Has nothing to do with it. And did you ever see Shin Kimigari Orange Road?
Yes, I did. And I have kind of the same reaction to it.
Yeah, I mean...
It feels like them restarting something and just like the engine won't turn over.
Well, it's also more in line with that movie than it is with the show.
Yeah, it's more somber and it's not all that into the ESP.
Yeah, yeah. K.O.R.
Yeah, well, you know, what this movie is basically, because the TV series and the OVAs after it were more or less entirely stuck in idle,
mm-hmm.
It was really stuck in neutral. Nothing fucking happened in that show.
Well, there was that episode where they're in Hawaii, and Madoka, like, is kidnapped or killed?
Oh, no, Hikaru's kidnapped.
Hikaru's kidnapped, and oh, God, that was stupid.
Like I said, nothing happens.
Yeah.
So basically, this movie is more or less a, oh shit, we have to have an ending. We have to make these characters grow. And they just cram it all into this movie for the absence of everything else.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work because nothing is earned by the movie. It's just like, hey, remember all this? Oh, well, we have to push this through to the ending now. And it's just like, no, that's not how you tell a story.
Well, you were reminded then that you don't like Kimigari Orange Road.
I don't hate it. I know a lot of people love it, but really, the best parts of that show are the opening sequences.
Yeah, yeah. Also super 80s. Like, really 80s.
Yeah.
The aesthetic's okay, I guess, if you like those big poofy haircuts.
KOR did nostalgia very well. I mean, it's a really strong and nostalgia show, and also had very, very, like, noteworthy use of music.
Yeah, that's true.
And those are two things that I think that this movie does carry on with pretty well. Although I have to say, when I did see this movie once before, but, you know, over 10 years ago, so I had very little memory of it. Mm. I just remember thinking at the times, like, you know, if anyone ever tries to market this in America and, like, you know, changes all the music to English, they should really use that Annie Lennox song, No More I Love Yous. I'm sure that AMV exists somewhere.
Oh, God. You know it does. Now, KOR hasn't been popular for, like, years, so...
Yeah. On VHS.
It's on a VHS in some guy's basement somewhere.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, I don't know. You can see why I recommended that, though.
I can, and very, very slightly insulted.
I'm sorry, that's not what I meant. <kidding. laughs> Okay, so the next thing that you recommended to me was, or the last anime you recommended to me was Windaria.
Yes.
Which I had forced on me 12 years ago by the old-timers in my anime club. So it kind of fell into the bubblegum crisis thing where... this is the most amazing thing. You have to see it. And they'd sit me down on the couch and I got to sit there and watch this fucking thing. And all I wanted to do was like, can we watch some Rurouni Kenshin? You know, right. That's all I wanted to watch back then. So I watched this last night. And Windaria is the story of two warring kingdoms and the little peaceful village that has a douchebag in it who picks a side and then betrays it. And it's kind of a weird movie. It's kind of like because it has this like fairy tale trapping.
It looks very trapping. You know, picture book for 8-year-olds.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a kindly old man has this big like dusty leather bound tome of fairy tales, and he's like, sit around, kids, and I'll tell you a story about how war is hell. And like, he was in the shit, and it's really gets really disturbing, and he's going on for way too long. there's a lot of stuff crammed in there. But these two warring kingdoms have the prince and the princess of these two kingdoms are secretly in love. And so there's a chance for peace, I guess, but war breaks out anyway, and it gets a little too like over the top tragic for its own good, near the end.
With the prince and princess, especially.
Oh God. Yeah. That scene is just so over the top. I was like, all right. What are you going for here? Pretty ridiculous. It's a neat movie and I'm glad I saw it. Backgrounds are nice. The animation's very 80s. 80s theatrical, you know, so it looks good, I guess.
I'd put it around Nausicaä as far as like globbiness, but still nice.
No, they ripped off Nausicaä completely too. Got the little fox squirrel thing and right. on a girl who looks like Nausicaä a little bit. But the main thrust of the story, and the story's a little all over the place because you're not really sure who you're supposed to be following, and they only get back to the main character, who I guess is supposed to be the main character, who's this guy from this neutral village.
Izu,
who joins, which side does he join?
He initially joins the invading kingdom.
The techno kingdom.
Right.
It's sort of techno versus magic kingdom, kind of a little bit. Or like provincial versus industrial.
Really. Right. That's a better way of putting it. There's no real magic.
There's no magic, but yeah, no, they do have, like flying machines and shit. And then he betrays them and completely winds up as a prince in there, or not a prince, but I don't know, valued hero.
Right. I mean, however, to whatever extent that sort of social hierarchy exists in a war.
And abandons his beloved. And winds up an overindulging, you know, guy with a harem of girls and like sitting on his side eating grapes and drinking wine and stuff. And they decide he's done. And it gets more tragic from there. It just goes downhill.
Oh my god, that ending is just a kick in the nads.
That ending is pretty brutal, but I was already laughing at how over the top tragic the whole thing was that it didn't surprise me. I was like, the end of this movie is just going to be like, and a big rock fell on all of them.
Oh, you're so cool, Zach.
No, but come on. I mean, it's pretty over the top.
It is, but at the same time, how can you not be at least a little bit shocked by a movie having the balls to have its main perky, you know, young and full of dreams and vigor protagonist crying a broken man at the feet of their god?
No, I get it.
Slow pan out
I get
music.
I think the prince and princess thing is kind of what I wish it had focused more on him.
Yeah.
The prince and princess thing was where it just got ridiculous for me. And it's like, all right, war is bad. Man, war sucks.
I agree. And that honestly, when I think of that movie, I don't think of them. I think of Izu and what happens to him.
Well, I'm curious. So this movie has been hacked up a number of times.
Oh, just once.
Just only the one time?
Only the one time. And that's the only way it's ever gotten an official release in the U.S.
So can I ask what's missing from that one?
About 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Most of
the story arc.
Oh, okay. What are the...
This was an early, well, not that early, post-Robotech, but pre-Streamline, Carl Masek, Harmony Gold hack and slash.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to make it into a kid's property.
Yeah, it's not a kid's movie.
Not at all. I mean, mind you, Harmony Gold, this is the company that also tried to do the same thing with that ridiculous Dracula anime, and literally the opening is like people chanting Satan, and they're trying to make a kid's property out of that. This one, they actually, like, they really rewrote the fuck out of it. They inserted all this narration where it didn't belong. Every time the character someone just took a breath, it's just bad. And unfortunately, ADV bought the rights to it and put it out on DVD. That's the only version they could get.
Right. And it was called Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, but the old streamlined tapes are called Windaria. So you say Windaria, this is the only thing most people have seen.
Well, no, most people have not even heard of this. So,
well, now, yeah.
Anyone who has, okay, I guess anyone who's seen it, that's the version that they've seen.
But it's so gorgeous for me. That ending with that lilting music is just one of the seminal anime tragedies for me.
Yeah.
It just made a huge impression on me.
All right. I mean, I kind of wish that, I don't know. I kind of wish I saw it a long time ago, you know? Well, I kind of wish I saw it a long time ago with eyes that wanted to see it, I guess.
Right.
Because I appreciated it. And it's a unique piece of work. Like, I am a little surprised that it doesn't have more of a reputation, I guess.
Yeah, it has a small but very fervent fan base in Japan. It's one of those that has been out of print, but the DVDs are going for an obscene amount on eBay, or I guess Yahoo Auctions in Japan.
Yeah.
But yeah, among U.S. fans, I think probably because of that dub, it just flew completely under the radar.
Yeah, I mean, if you could track down a copy of it and you're interested in anime history and you want to see something that is not like anything else, yeah, definitely check it out. I don't know. Emotionally, I didn't. I think I was just having a little bit too much fun with how over the top
it was. Fair enough. With, you know, the thick layer of irony that I watch stuff with today, I think that might be unavoidable. But, you know, having seen it as an impressionable teenager, it made a very, very deep mark on me. So,
yeah. Cool. All right. Well, so that was Windaria. And the last thing is...
For me was Wolf's Rain.
Right. The end, specifically the end of Wolf's Rain.
Right. I, like so many others, lost interest around... now, not because of the four recap episodes that happened because the studio was shut down because of SARS.
Mm-hmm.
But the episode... I knew enough to skip those because I came late enough.
Yeah.
But those episodes specifically around that break are already really saggy.
Mm.
It loses a lot of momentum right there. So I never saw the ending. I crapped out around episode 19 or so, and I'm just like, I'll get to it. And I never did.
Mm-hmm.
So you insisted that I see it, and holy shit. And I'm angry with myself that it took me this long to see this.
Isn't it good?
Holy fuck.
The last four specifically, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it has to force itself to a conclusion for where the TV run ended, which is clearly not where they meant to leave off, and it doesn't really work.
Yeah.
This show does have a significant problem where for 90% of the running time, you have no idea why the fuck the humans are there.
Yeah, right. I mean, and their purpose becomes very obvious in the last four episodes.
Right.
You know, why they're there is for a very strong emotional impact. But yeah, no, you're right. And I think even the four before the final four, because it's like after the filler, there's eight episodes left.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, the filler's on its own disc, which is great. You can just skip it.
Yeah.
Because I actually went back and rewatched the entire show. In anticipation of this, because I hadn't seen it since 2004, 2005-ish. And I was like, man, I remember really liking the ending of that. And people shat on it for some reason.
How can you shit on that?
I don't know. I think people were just being dumbasses back then. But, like, having revisited it now, most of the show, it's another one of those things where the climax totally pays off the rest of it. And there are a few episodes that feel kind of stupid, like the one where they fight the evil walrus.
Yes.
Why is that even in there? And there's there's a couple episodes you're like, why am I learning? There's a whole episode that's nothing but backstory for the reporter, Hub, and the wolf hunter, the drunk wolf hunter.
Yeah, completely unimportant.
Yeah, it's unimportant, but I'm glad I know that stuff because it helps me care about them at the end.
Right.
Because they're literally like the last humans on Earth at the end of that show. And, yeah, so it's important, but, and anyway,
The show basically needed editing. Is the problem?
It could have worked. It could have worked as a 13er.
Yeah, and it could. I think that might have been a little tight. It definitely could have done with like 20 episodes.
Well, you could have cut out what's his face, the main villain. You could have cut him out and replaced him with Jaguara, and there wouldn't have been a big difference.
Right.
It feels like that feels a little unnecessary.
A little redundant.
Yeah, I mean, if Jaguara had been that character, and they destroyed the city and then moved on from there, that would have worked too, and you would have cut down the show a lot. But I mean, it's flawed. It's not a perfect show, but it's really fucking good.
But two or three points I want to make on this. The first one is Yoko Kanno. This is her masterpiece, as far as I'm concerned.
You think so?
Yes, because one problem that happens again and again with her soundtracks of this era is that her music stands out so much that it does, even though it might be fantastic music and I can't wait to buy the soundtrack, it doesn't necessarily work or add anything to the scene. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem with showy soundtracks, is that on their own merits, they might be fantastic, but they don't really do their job of ratcheting up the tension or setting the mood all that effectively. And, you know, her stuff is very spotty. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes it doesn't really work. With Wolf's Rain, I think she played it very conservative with how showy she wanted to be. It's all like based in like mellow jazz and kind of, you know, adult contemporary rock. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't stand out, but as a result, it just kind of gives you this undercurrent of like familial bonding, and it enhances the mood without calling attention to itself, which is what a great soundtrack should do.
Yeah, no, the music's great. Especially, I really love the opening song. It's really good.
Opening song's great. It has actually the song Strangers, which is my all-time favorite anime song ever.
Okay.
but I also want to call out Keiko Nobumoto, who is the writer and also basically the Japanese equivalent of showrunner. She is the head writer. It was her original story. And also she was a contributing writer to Cowboy Bebop, Tokyo Godfathers. She is one of the greats of anime screenwriting.
No shit.
Nobody pays her any attention.
Yeah. Wow.
Like you never hear her name come up.
Yeah.
And she hasn't really done much in the last couple of years. But holy shit, she is, it pisses me off when someone contributes so much to some of the best loved anime in the whole history of animation, of anime, and nobody knows her name.
That's a good point. Has she done anything more recent?
No, she did one episode of Samurai Champloo. Mm. Her biography and her filmography is not all that long. Literally, Wolf's Rain, Tokyo Godfathers, Macross Plus. Oh, yeah, Macross Plus. How about that one? Cowboy Bebop, and that was pretty much it. It's also like a couple tiny specials that no one here has seen. Hmm. And that's it.
Wow. All right. Well, one of the unsung heroes.
Yeah. The other one, by the way, Mary Elizabeth McGlynn,
mm-hmm.
Directed this dub.
The dub's great.
The dub is flawless.
Yeah.
Directed Cowboy Bebop. Standalone Complex. She is one of literally three or four of the best anime voice ADR voice directors. Nobody even knows her as a director. Everyone thinks of her as a voice actress. She is possibly one of the best directors that we have.
Right.
So that's just kind of, that's two women that are just incredibly talented that I'm really kind of amazed that nobody really knows their work as well as they should, I feel.
Right. Well, okay, so specifically the end of this show.
Yes.
I want to talk about these last four episodes because I think it might be the most, one of the best conclusions I've ever seen.
Mm.
And it fulfills the promise of the show and turns it into something truly apocalyptic.
Yeah.
Somebody on Twitter, I was talking about this show on Twitter because I was rewatching it, and someone was like, "Nah, I never really felt like it was the apocalypse." I'm like, "Are you fucking kidding me? Like, they've given up hope. They're not trying to save the world. They're trying to find a place that they can go. Like, literally, that's it. And the end of that, they're trudging across a wasteland, dying off as they go.
While the ground is breaking up beneath them.
While the ground is breaking up beneath them, shooting stars are coming down.
Windstorms, sandstorms.
Yeah, they've left behind what's left of humanity, which was walled up in the city that got destroyed after their failed attempt to open paradise. And it's just these four wolves and their human friends failing to make it to paradise, basically, slowly. But the one thing that really stands out to me about this show is that the characters are so well done, especially the four wolves.
Yeah.
Really great characters. And you really care about them. I mean, like Sume, the Crispin Freeman character, who's got a kind of a hilarious 80s outfit.
Oh, yeah. He looks like some sort of bondage.
He looks like an extra from a Mad Max movie.
Yeah.
But he changes and he becomes sort of caring and a little warm. And you notice that character change. I mean, it's really good writing. That kind of character writing is really rare.
Yeah.
My favorite character was Toboy. The little redhead kid who's...
Oh, he's great. He's with the Mary Tyler Moore haircut.
Yeah, he's a puppy. And it's horrible what happens to him. It's really sad. But that, again, it's really well set up. Like, you understand why what happens happens. He has a really complicated relationship with human beings. And there's an especially tragic thing in his past that's really effectively told. I loved all of those characters. And I you know, what we were talking about, why are the humans in this? And it's like, oh, so you can see, like, how tragic it is that they, what happens to them. Like, it's, these are the last human beings in the world. The world is ending. We're done. This is what's left, and this is what happens to them. And what happens to them is, it's really sad.
my personal favorite character is actually Hige, because, you know, he was... I always liked him because he was, you know, the kind of voice of reason, but with a wisecrack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always really interesting to me when that guy who kind of lives behind this you know, veneer of humor, all that gets stripped away and you see what's really underneath. And it's he becomes, I think, one of the most compelling characters of the show, which is saying a lot.
Yeah, right. And I like the fact that that over the course of the show – Kiba is not, I mean, he's a leader, but everybody is kind of like, you only give a shit about this. You don't care about us. Why are we even doing this? You know, like, there's a lot of doubt, and it's, and it's very realistic. Like,
yeah,
the character interaction is extremely well done.
And Kiba is very just kind of blindly driven. And I've known people like that who just are after that goal to the detriment of everything else.
Right. Yeah,
and they miss the forest for the trees, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not a character you dislike, like, you kind of understand, but I don't know. It's a relentless push that, yeah, it just works. Like, that thing is firing on all cylinders in the end. And those were OVA episodes.
Yeah.
Those came out on DVD, like, after the show was over. And it's nice that they were able to stretch out like that.
Yeah, thank God for that, because without it, that show wouldn't be anywhere near what it is.
No, if it ended where the TV show ended, it's like, huh?
And the last scene, talk about giving you exactly what you wanted before you really realized you wanted it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, they basically hit the reset button. And I like that in an apocalypse story.
Even exactly a reset button. It's, oh... Oh, that's what that was.
Right.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, man, it's special. I'm glad you liked it. I there's a reason I was like, man, that was a great fucking show. And like,
Like I said, I'm angry with myself for having not seen it this long, because it really is, for all its faults, and it does have faults, it is one of the seminal works of anime as far as I'm concerned.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. If you can track it down and you haven't seen it, absolutely check it out.
If you can track it down, the cheap box set's down to under $30.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I you're right. You can get it, so track it down.
Yeah, and there's no excuse anymore. I mean, you know, at that price, come on.
Yeah, I mean, I remember there was a huge backlash to the ending when it finally came out. I think those fillers, I think it would be remembered better without those. Obviously, it would be remembered better without those fillers.
Right.
And those fillers really damaged its reputation. But now that you can go back and ignore the fillers... and see it for what it really is, it's special.
Well, once you get the box, just take out disc 5, throw it in the trash. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. Set it aside. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I lucked out. I found that special limited collector's box, the weird, you know, that weird sort of trapezoidal thing mm-hmm. that came with the soundtrack. Found out for $30 at FYE.
Wow.
It goes for $200 on Amazon.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Well, which soundtrack? Is it the first one?
Just the first one, yeah.
Okay.
If you look up
already.
If you look up those soundtracks, they go for hundreds of dollars.
Oh my god.
Stuff is out of print. So yeah. I think that was a successful experiment.
Yeah, I mean, even if we didn't love everything, we at least appreciated them all.
Sure. That will change as we go into movies.
A lot.
So we also did this for movies, obviously. And I recommended 3 to you. You recommended 3 to me. And why don't you start here?
Okay, well, the first one that I saw that you recommended to me was The Fifth Element.
Yes.
Which I had seen in the theater, but not since. And I was really young. This came out in, what, 97? So I was 17.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, just turned 17. And I was, A, unfamiliar with French sci-fi. And this is very French sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is basically a Mobius comic.
basically, yeah.
And also, like, I appreciated the visuals at the time, but, you know, it didn't really... Something didn't click. I don't know what exactly. But upon revisiting it, I was really kind of surprised at how much I enjoyed myself.
It's a very fun movie.
It is so much fun. And now that I have the 5.1 system, I feel like I need to watch it again.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, watching it in stereo, I'm like, But, yeah, I mean, if this movie has one significant problem, it's the Chris Tucker character.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is one of my all-time favorite movies, so I even love that. But I acknowledge that it's an issue.
Yeah. I mean, he's basically just there to be kind of a flamboyant stereotype. And I appreciate that they're trying to use him as a Greek chorus.
Kind of. I think he's just it's over-the-top comedy relief. It is. Yeah. It is French, you know?
Yeah, so their comedy is... awful.
It's their comedy.
Yeah. But it's so much fun, and the character Lelou is very compelling, and so is Bruce Willis' character. It's who I can only think of as Bruce Willis.
Yeah, well, he plays Bruce Willis and everything, so.
Right. but it's just a lot of fun, and the music is good. It really, surprisingly, hasn't aged at all visually.
Yeah, not really. It's a combo. The CG is limited to the space stuff, and everything else is practical, and that works.
Yeah.
That gives it kind of a timeless sort of feel. Movies that have a lot of practical effects tend to age better than movies with too much CG.
At the same time, I think it came out just late enough that they could use digital compositing instead of analog matte cutting, yeah. Which takes me out of movies now when I see that.
Yeah.
because you see that, like, little kind of wavy black halo around things, and you're like, okay, I literally can picture a guy with an X-Acto blade cutting every scene.
Yeah, you want to see the absolute worst example of that, the Star Trek The Motion Picture on Blu-ray. They didn't clean it up at all. There are giant black boxes around everything.
I even see it with older anime, because, you know, they used to use that a lot when things were too hard to layer.
Right.
But... yeah, this still looks really good, and I'm going to have to buy this Blu-ray once I get this back to you.
Yeah, and you know, you said it's super French sci-fi. It is, but it also has a giant anime influence. Like, it's very clear. There's a heavy anime influence on this thing.
You think?
Absolutely. Look at Lelou.
Well, okay, yeah, she's a hot redheaded girl who doesn't wear much clothing.
Right. Well, and the outfits in particular are very it's very anime-ish.
That's true.
I felt the whole thing was very anime-ish.
Yeah, you know what I was actually reminded of a lot is that show Valerian and Laureline.
Yeah, right.
which is actually came much after that, but pretty much exactly the same note.
Right.
And exactly the same sense of humor and the same sense of fun, by the way, I recommend that show quite a bit.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to watch that now.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm glad you responded to it. I kind of knew you would. I'm kind of like, well, you haven't, because it had come up in conversation, and you're like, ah, fuck that movie. And I'm like, wait, when's the last time you saw it? And you're like, 1997. I'm like, oh shit, you got to see that. You got to see that again.
Yeah, I don't really understand why it works better as an adult. I don't really understand what I was missing before, but hey, whatever.
Maybe you're
I get it now.
Maybe you were in a bad mood. When I saw it as a teenager, I flipped. I flipped for it. Like, I made my parents go see it. I think I saw that something like 7 or 8 times in the theaters.
My dad liked it way more than I did. He's a big sci-fi fan.
Yeah. No, I think it's a classic, I think, at this point. It's going to go down, and especially because it aged so well.
Yeah, that's a real surprise. It's so rare to find sci-fi that ages well.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, so that was a success. First thing you gave me was Fish Tank, which is a British angsty teen movie. How unpredictable.
I
I
have to have one.
I liked Fish Tank. This is about a British girl living in pretty abject poverty with a slutty mom who is seeing a very questionable man who takes an interest in her, and she's sort of extremely angry and desperate to get out of her situation, and has aspirations to become a dancer. I liked this movie. I think it had some pacing issues. I didn't like the incredibly overt, obvious visual metaphors that it uses. I mean, like, the least subtle visual metaphors. And I'm a Nutella fan, and this thing was too, this was too much for me. Where she's, like, trying to save the chained-up horse. It's like, all right. Why is there a horse there? Oh, because it's a metaphor. But what I really liked about it was, A, her performance.
She is really good.
She's really, really good. Really, really good at that character. And even though it's a little frustrating to just watch a brooding teenager, mm-hmm. when it's done really well, you know, you connect with it, you recognize those emotions, and it is done really well. And it goes into the obvious place. So she's, her mother is dating this guy who turns out to have an interest in little girls, and it gets inappropriate. But the way that they handled that, I feel like, is better than I normally see that kind of thing handled. It seems like every couple of years there's a movie about a pedophile that gets acclaim. And this one felt like it was handled better. I don't know what it was about it specifically, but it felt more subtle. It felt, you know, you're in the perspective of this character, the lead character, so much that the way it's handled is he's distanced immediately and she basically runs from it. And that's handled really well, I feel like.
Right. And it's interesting because it's not it plays such a straight narrative that it's most of those movies, I think, make the critical mistake of saying this is really bad right away.
Yeah.
And just really being, you know, whoever is there is just clearly, you know, inches away from snarling bad guy.
Yeah, and I think it's testament to this movie's power and effectiveness as you are inside this teenage girl's head.
Right. You see exactly why she finds him attractive. You understand exactly what's going on in her head, and you can kind of get where he's coming from, although he's clearly in the wrong.
Right. Well, yeah, I guess, but it's the singular focus of the film, and the fact that it's dedicated to that focus and it sticks to it the whole way through is what's powerful about the film. I think.
Right. I mean, the whole thing is even shot, you know, 4:3.
Yeah.
To kind of give you her tunnel vision.
And even further narrow your perspective in this already incredibly narrow perspective that you're in.
Right. And it's suffocating as well. You feel just as uncomfortable being in that crappy east of London housing development as she does.
Right. Well, hence the name of the film, Fish Tank.
Right.
Yeah. No, good stuff. I liked it. I didn't love it. I did, you know, it does have pacing problems, but good movie. Definitely good movie. I'm very glad I saw it.
Yeah. It pushed all my buttons. I was literally watching this on Netflix, paused it to go to Barnes & Noble to buy it.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, it is my kind of movie. But at the same time, it's really, really, really well done. What did you call it when you first saw it? what Precious could have been if it wasn't racist and awful.
Yeah, like, it is, because there's a genre of movies that's poverty porn, where it's like, look at the squalor these people live in, and look at the horrible things that happen to them, and this totally could have been that, but it wasn't. It's not really poverty porn, whereas Precious totally is poverty porn. you know, at no point does the lead character in this, you know, run down the street with a bucket of stolen chicken. but, yeah, no, it did kind of seem like the opposite of Precious. Like, oh, if you actually make a sincere and well-observed movie about poverty, you can do a lot more and say a lot more than just have this sort of racist cartoon play out in front of you. Yeah. Yeah. The worst thing about this movie is that it reminded me of Precious.
Well, that's pretty bad. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. So the next film that you recommended to me that I saw, holy shit, did I hate this movie. Holy shit, did I hate this movie. I had trouble getting through it. I was literally pacing, like, head and hands, going, oh, my God.
I got to tell you, that pleases me.
Really?
I love that you had that.
Was this a troll, Zach?
No, it was not a troll, but I love the fact that you hated it so much. So, anyway, go.
Okay, this is the Seth Rogen movie, the Seth Rogen bomb, Observe and Report.
You wonder why it was a bomb?
Well, aside from the fact that it came out like a month after Paul Blart Mall Cop.
Yeah, except that it's like that movie crossed with Taxi Driver.
See, here's where this is not Taxi Driver, or even, okay, I should explain, first of all, this movie is about a mall rent-a-cop who is pretty much the most odious, awful person on the planet. He is racist, violently racist. He has an uncontrolled temper. He's stupid. He has, you know, very, very simple tastes. He is utterly free of any sympathetic characteristics whatsoever.
Yes, that was intentional, but go on.
Oh, I'm sure it was. And, you know, as a writing exercise, the whole concept of let's just make a dopey Hollywood comedy with the least likable protagonist in the world is an interesting one. But the problem here is that he is so unlikable. I mean, he doesn't even appear on this. He appears on the screen and your flesh crawls. He is the worst person on the planet. And the very fact that he is in front of you and not exploding into flames is appalling.
Wow. Boy, you hated this movie.
I hated this movie like I hate syphilis. I'm going to give this away. It has a happy ending. It gives him what he wants. Mm-hmm. If he had died in a car accident, if he had even if he had lost a limb, I would have been happy. He was fine. He got what he wanted, maybe not exactly what he wanted, but he has a happy ending, therefore rewarding it. And I'm sorry, there is nothing on this planet, no amount of great writing sleight of hand, that can make a character this thoroughly unpleasant, give him a happy ending, and have that be a good thing for the audience. There just isn't. I mean, you look at the great asshole protagonists in comedy history. Let's just take It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia as an example. Okay. Those are some shitty people. You would never want them in your life, let alone your house. But at the same time, they're kind of fun to watch because there's kind of this stupid innocence about them. They don't understand why they're being an asshole. And they just will destroy themselves every week in the process of being that stupid. This guy gets the girl. This guy kind of, you know, has an okay life at the end. I find that unacceptable.
Well, to be fair, everyone in the movie is horrible. Like, there is not a single likable character in that movie. They're all awful, with the exception of, you know, the coffee, the donut store girl.
Yeah,
maybe
who likes him for some reason. Fuck.
Look, yes, this is that movie is so sort of indescribably dark and fucked up, and that's why I like it so much, because it got released. Somehow that got made. It is so fucked up. And it, you have to, I mean, your sense of humor has to be truly, truly dark to really, to appreciate that, that movie. It's kind of barely really a comedy. It's more like horrible things and horrible people. And I just like the balls on it. I like the balls on it. I think it's, I do find it legitimately funny. I think it's kind of hilarious that the movie dares to end with a naked fat man getting just point blank graphically shot in the chest. Holy shit, they actually did that. Like, wow. And yeah, the main character's awful, but he's supposed to be. It's the reason I call it Taxi Driver is because he's, you know, it's clearly modeled on Travis Bickle. Like, very clearly. Right. He's got this vengeance streak in him. But yeah, no, I don't know. That movie is
It's not a vengeance streak, though. He's not smart enough to have a vengeance streak. It's just pure delusion of grandeur.
Right. It's an authority complex.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, and then they kind of go out of their way to point out that he is incredibly mentally unstable and fucked up, given the fact that part of his recovery is he, you know, they go through the whole rehab sequence where he's on all these drugs to fix his brain. And it doesn't really take. I mean, it kind of works, but yeah, no. I thought that you might appreciate that movie for being as dark and fucked up as it is.
How do you rectify the ending, though? How is that acceptable to you? I don't understand.
I'm okay with the ending because it's in service of the fact that the movie is not going to give you what you want. It's not going to pull any punches. I don't know. I'm okay with the ending. I mean, it's just him dragging the bloody body of the flasher up the stairs of the courthouse. That is so screwed up. The whole movie is an exercise in mental instability.
Well, it is sort of this cartoon world where everyone kind of gets to be an asshole with no
consequences.
No consequences. I mean, the police are basically just clubbing people.
Yeah, the Ray Liotta character is ridiculous.
Right. And at the same time, I was so annoyed with the Seth Rogen character that I actually felt for the Ray Liotta character.
Okay, wow.
I was sympathetic to him. I could picture myself reacting the same way to this clown.
I can see that. I also actually really loved the Anna Faris character.
Yeah, she was great.
Well, I feel like she finally gets to just take it. Like, she's usually in these shitty spoof comedies. And yeah, in this one, she
finally... The house bunny.
Yeah, in this one, she actually gets to totally just be the worst person in the world.
Yeah, no, she was actually the bright spot in the movie for me.
Yeah, no, but it was a gamble, and it did not pay off.
No. If I see a cup, once this DVD and it's or once this Blu-ray, and this is purely out of reverence for you, that I have not set fire to this.
I hope not. It's my copy.
Well, I would have Amazoned you a new one, but I once this leaves my house, I will probably salt the front door or something. I don't know. Awful, well, awful, sorry. Piece of work. And you have one that you didn't like.
Okay, I didn't like it. I didn't hate it as with the fire of a thousand suns like you hated Observe and Report. Okay, so the one you gave me that I didn't like was called Match Factory Girl, which is actually a Criterion title. And I guess this teaches me that I'm not going to like everything in the Criterion collection. So this is a Finnish movie about a girl who works in a match factory who is depressed and lonely and has a crappy social life, meets a guy, sleeps with him, gets pregnant. Her parents disapprove, kick her out of the house. The guy wants nothing to do with her, so she poisons them all. That is what happens in Match Factory Girl. Mm-hmm. That is all that happens in Match Factory Girl.
Uh-huh.
There is nothing else going on in this movie. It could have been accomplished in 20 minutes, takes an hour and 10 minutes, but feels like 8 hours. Because for some reason, the director wants to hold the shot every time, all the time. Doesn't matter what's happening. She could just be staring into nothing, or reading a book, or peeling an orange. And we're just there watching it. No reason to hold the shot, but let's just hold it for fucking ever. And I couldn't figure out what the artistic merit of doing that was. And, you know, I try to appreciate these things. I saw stuff like this in film school. It's the kind of thing you do see in film school. I did not see the artistic merit in this movie being so fucking slow that you want to rip your hair out. The scene where the guy who impregnates her is sitting with her parents and they're just sitting there in awkward silence. It's like 5 minutes long. At least it feels like it's that long. It's forever. And you're like, what is the purpose of this? The information that needs to be imparted to me has been imparted. This is not a particularly lovely shot. It's not even particularly that great looking a film. The camera just sits there for no fucking reason. And it made me frustrated. I don't get it. Can you explain to me what it is about that kind of pacing that has artistic merit and means something beyond let's just hold this shot forever?
Okay. When you were in film school or maybe after, did you ever see, also a Criterion release, Chantal Ackerman's Jeannie Dielman at 23 Quai de Commerce, whatever it's called?
Nope.
Okay. Have you heard of it?
No, actually.
Okay. There's a whole, like Germanic European film movement that started in the 70s that you should probably avoid like the plague. Mm. And what it is basically the daily machinations of life in like shitty proletariat society, where you're just almost observed as a still life. That movie, Jeannie Dielman, is well over 3 hours long and it's shots that last for 20 minutes. You should avoid it like the plague. Sounds now, like I went torture. Into that, and that movie did test my patience quite a bit. But after a while, it's almost like listening to the and slightly getting into the drumbeat of the vibration when you're getting an MRI. Hmm. You notice little things. You feel you almost absorb the mood of, like, in this case, the crushing poverty and the just the feel of it. Now, I'll admit, I went back and rewatched this after I recommended it to you, and it was a little slower than I remember.
Just a little, you say?
Just a little. But I don't think, had that been 20 minutes long, as you say, the narrative could have been, it would not have felt the same. It would not have felt as oppressive. It would not have felt as... basically, without anything happening, I feel like Karasmaki kind of made this into a Todd Solondz movie without actually having to do anything.
To me, it's just the camera. Just the camera fucking sitting there for no reason.
Yeah.
It felt like pretense.
Yeah.
Like, if I hold this shot forever, this will have artistic... No, it's just boring. It's just boring and it goes nowhere. And I was shouting at the screen, get on with it! Get on with it! What is the next thing that's going to happen? Like, it's 40 minutes in before she even realizes she's pregnant. 40 minutes of nothing! I started narrating the shots of the Match Factory. Like, industry! Like, I was so bored.
I'm always surprised because you have, as I do, a seemingly strong tolerance for slow films.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's I'm a little surprised that you're not that you don't seem to connect with stuff that you just sit in as much as I don't know. I can't see the pattern.
I you know what, if I could explain it to you exactly, I would. But this, to me, is not the fun or interesting kind of boring. This is just boring. The fact that it's ugly and set in, you know, this impoverished part of Finland doesn't help. If it's going to be dull, I kind of also want it to be pretty. And maybe that's me being shallow. But, you know, the reason that I love, like, the super slow shots and stuff, like There Will Be Blood, is because there's a weird kind of beauty to it. Same thing with Tree of Life. Same thing.
I don't even consider those slow movies.
I think they're fairly slow, both of them. And I like that. But those are pretty films. And it's not just like a simple like, ooh, this is pretty, I'll stare at this for a while. That's where I kind of want to marinate it, like long shots of the desert. You know, stuff like that. I'm okay with that. But this is just oppressive. And I understand, like, that's what they're going for. Like, oh, you're going to feel the proletariat. Like, you're going to feel it. It's like, yeah, how long do I need to feel it?
It's only an hour.
It's only an hour, like the longest hour, though. Like the longest hour.
I don't know. I get it though. I really do. It's if you're not used to sitting in moods, and if that's not your thing, this movie will probably be torture.
Yeah.
And the fact that you got anything out of it is probably just a, is I okay. I understand.
Yeah. Woof. Like, however, like I will say though, like if you're into this kind of thing, I mean, this is hailed as a seminal work. Yeah. So totally.
I realized I might be coming off as a little bit condescending about it, but it is a seminal work, and you know, it's a Criterion release, so
I totally understand it, but I'm not going to fake that I like it, because faking that you like something because it's acclaimed.
Oh no, I wouldn't expect you to.
Is worse than I mean I'm okay if people think I'm a Philistine because I don't like Match Factory Girl. That's fine with me. That's okay. But anyway, so we're going to end this on a happier note.
Right.
Hopefully. So the next thing I recommended to you, or the last thing was...
That was Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused.
Yeah, which I was really torn on whether or not to recommend it to you.
Yeah, and it came out around the time I started getting interested in, you know, indie films, because, you know, the 90s and early 2000s were a really interesting time for indie film. Mm. And it had a lot of actors I really liked, like Parker Posey, and I forget who else is in it, but a lot of people who later became pretty big.
Yeah, lots of people who became pretty big, actually.
Yeah. the protagonist, not among them, and I'll get back to that. But I avoided it because I have a fairly hard 70s allergy. Mm. And it's related to my dislike of dirty feeling. Like, I couldn't watch Westerns for the longest time. And the 70s for me just have this kind of caked with grunge feel to it. Like, the fashions for guys back then were basically I let myself go.
I had a friend once say, the 70s, seven movies made in the 70s look like they smell like unwashed pubes.
Exactly. It looks and feels grotesque. People are chain smoking. You have those horrible tinted glasses everywhere. And some of it has ruined part of the 80s for me. Like the non-MTV part of the 80s is like it reeks like the 70s for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I see these 70s stuff and I just feel like a board game bought at a garage sale that feels like it's been in the mouths of both dogs and a toddler.
And someone used it as an ashtray for 10 years.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's why I avoided Dazed and Confused for so long. That, and I'm not a huge Richard Linklater fan. But I really like this film. Hmm. And it doesn't have that 70s gross feeling to it, because it's the 70s put through the 90s. Not one of these characters would look maybe a little out of place, but not fashion disasters for the 90s. And the 90s are much more palatable.
Well,
people
washed
then.
You're right in that it is sanitized. It is very sanitized. The movie's not doesn't look dirty at all.
No,
it's like the cleanest possible 1970s.
Yeah, the 70s did not exist.
Yeah,
it's a very romanticized 70s and not particularly realistic, I imagine.
Right.
But I wasn't around, thank Christ, so I have no idea. But it takes place on the last day of school in 1976, right before summer vacation, in what appears to be a small town near Austin, Texas. And it's a small high school, very close-knit, and there's a tradition of hazing the incoming freshmen. The guys get paddled by the football team. It's a bit much, to be honest, and the girls get like a bunch of crap dumped on them in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And not that I would ever enjoy that or condone that. In fact, I found it pretty repellent. But at the same time, I kind of understood it in a way I didn't understand hazing before. It's basically bonding with your elders through Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty repellent. But at the same time, it did a really nice job of fleshing out all the characters. It's this big ensemble character study, basically. And they were interesting, and they were sympathetic, and it really painted a really nice, vivid, if romanticized, portrait of what, you know, life was like probably for them back then, even if you hated high school. And who doesn't hate high school?
Right.
You know, that's if I find anything maddening about anime, it's that it over romanticizes what is almost universally a shitty time in people's lives. You know, the fact that it owned up to that and yet still had the nostalgia effect on full blast, I thought was quite an achievement. And although I will say, there's this one guy in it who's a lead, the guy that plays Pink. I think his name's Jason London.
Jason London, yep.
Is a heinous actor.
Oh, he's bad.
Yeah. He is so bad that he does this thing, and you learn about this in film school, where, and this is especially bad early on, where he over-emotes with his arms.
Yep.
Acting 101. That is how you tell someone is an amateur actor who is not doing well, is that they're using their arms way too much.
It's Jeremy London, not Jason London. This is how bad he is. He's the worst actor in Mallrats.
Ooh. No, the list here says Jason London.
Jason London. Okay, I thought it was Jeremy London. All right, anyway, Jason London. Yeah, no, he's the worst thing in Mallrats.
Yeah, and he's basically one of the only central cast members here that hasn't gone on to have much of a career.
Right, everyone else.
For good reason.
It's full of famous people otherwise, you know. Ben Affleck, Matthew McConaughey is famous for his line in that movie, but...
Right.
Yeah. No.
Well, there's one other actor who I thought was really, really good. This guy who plays Mitch, who's one of the incoming freshmen. His name's Wiley Wiggins, who apparently they just plucked off of Austin Straits to be in it. Is really, really good. He's like the long-haired kid who kind of looks vaguely like a young Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who is the one freshman that kind of ends up hanging in with the jocks by the end of it.
Right.
He is really, really, really good. It's unfortunate to see that he moved to Hollywood and, you know, Hollywood ate him alive. And I think now he's working, duplicating tapes at a service bureau.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But, it's interesting to see what happened to all the actors. And, I enjoyed this film. It's a fun film to experience. I'm not sure I need to see it again, but it's nice.
Yeah, I've seen it a couple times. It's probably more than a couple times. It's a very much put it on in the background kind of a movie because the mood is so light and the mood is so easygoing. And even though, you know, it is saying something about youth and the uncertainty of the end of high school and all that, it's more just like, hey, check out this time and place. Like,
yeah.
Which is neat. And it's a really well-structured, entertaining, well-paced way to do that. There's a reason it's beloved. And, you know, it's kind of a chill-out movie. And I'm glad you liked it. Could have gone either way because it is kind of it's got a little bit of a coming-of-age aspect to it. And I know you don't like that unless it's chock-full of anger. So... Then that movie
really it has enough anger. I don't mind.
It's got a little bit in it.
it acknowledges that it's not a nice time, and that's all I really ask.
Right? Yeah.
I think if you don't acknowledge that those years suck for most people, you're being disingenuous. And if it didn't suck for you, it means you're probably a bad person.
Yeah, like young adult.
Right. So at any rate, well, I think that easygoing feeling is the reason that even the grotesque things like the hazing are – you can't really take too much offense to them.
Yeah. I mean, I don't find that to be particularly grotesque. I find it to be sort of like, oh, well, time and place. You know, like that's sort of what happened back then. It's
right.
Also kind of amazing because
– before people started dying from hazing.
Well, that – and it's like, God, you could not even remotely get away with any of this shit now. Like,
no.
Holy crap. Like, God, people were free and easy back then.
Right.
Even though it's a fictionalization, you know, it's not based on nothing.
No, also, I mean, each one of those kids would be in jail for assault these days.
Yeah, also that movie reminds me of Freaks and Geeks in terms of its tone and its pacing.
Which I've never seen, and I always say I need to, but...
Yeah, you should. If you like Dazed and Confused, you'll like Freaks and Geeks.
Oh, fair enough.
But, yeah, so the... last thing that got recommended to me was this movie called Central Station, which is Brazilian, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is about a cranky granny who works in a train station and who, if you're illiterate, you can tell her, you can have her write your letter for you. And she's supposed to mail it, but she doesn't, or often doesn't. She sort of saves these sort of sad sack letters. And there's a boy gets orphaned, and she sort of takes him in. And she's really, she's got a hard edge to her. She's not a nice person. But then he goes to the they send him off to the orphanage, and she finds out that they abuse kids at that orphanage.
Oh, no, it goes further than that. They harvest organs from the kids.
Right, yes, okay, there you go. They don't just abuse them, they steal their organs.
And she got paid for it.
And she did. Right, she sells the kid to the orphanage. Right, so this is a bad person. So she sells the kid to the orphanage that harvests them for... And she finds out about the organ harvesting, and then she goes to rescue him.
Right.
So she rescues him, and then is sort of determined to help him find his father, right?
Yeah, basically, she's wrecked by guilt. She just kind of grudgingly... They embark on a cross-country bus trip.
Right. And there you have a movie. Mm-hmm. I like this movie. It really... I am shocked it did not get remade. Shocked. Because the plot is so, like, Harvey Weinstein remakes this and it wins Best Picture. It really felt like that kind of a movie to me.
Yeah, and it is. It's a very big, you know... It's a heartstring tugging crowd pleaser is what it is.
Yeah, but except for the fact that it's sort of bogged down by the pacing. If it were paced more like an American film, then it would win, you know, then it would be nominated for Best Picture. But the fact is, it lingers. It lingers a lot. Which is fine. I liked that. I really liked the travelogue style of the travelogue storytelling in it. The most fascinating thing, I mean, the story was kind of, yeah, all right. Okay, nice premise. But what I really liked about it was the fact that I saw so much of Brazil that I would otherwise not ever see. The locations in it are things you don't see, you know, neighborhoods and suburbs and roadsides of Brazil. I've never seen a movie that has any of that in it.
Yeah, and these are really remote villages.
Yeah, it's really far. Yeah, they're in the middle of nowhere. I thought the cinematography was nice. It's a good looking film, at least you as much as you can get from the terrible DVD.
Right. Yeah. The DVD that this is on was actually an early, I think almost a launch DVD title. So it came out in 98 and it's hard subbed, matted widescreen, not anamorphic. And it looks bad.
Yeah, I'm sure my TV wasn't stretched, but it filled the screen for me.
Oh, well, it might have stretched it automatically, then sensing the black bars or something.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think my player does that. But, yeah, no, it was probably blown up because it looked horrible. Like, the DVD looked just awful. But you know, regardless of that, it's a sweet movie with, you know, the ending. It ends like you would expect a foreign film like this to end. I think if it were American, the orphan would have wound up living with her, and she would have been his surrogate mother or whatever. But
right.
In this, you know, she leaves him with...
She leaves him with his brothers. His parents are dead.
Yeah, no. So she leaves him with his brothers, with his closest relatives. And there's like a moment where she seems like she regrets it. But it's, you know, then the movie ends. So, yeah, it's a nice little movie. I didn't think it was particularly special or anything. It was just a nice little movie.
The reason I love this movie so much is I relate and sympathize with the old lady as she really struggles to regain her humanity. It's not an easy path for her. The kid's a pain in the ass. He's demanding, but he kind of forces her back onto the right path.
Mm.
And, you know, she resents him for it, and she basically goes on this trip with him out of a feeling of guilt. But by the end of it, she's kind of remembering everything that she's lost or given up over the years. And I found that incredibly compelling and something that you don't really even see much, even in the heartstring tuggers.
Yeah, that's true. There's a redemptive aspect to it that is effective. I did care about these characters by the end of the movie. It starts out a little cartoony, like she's so cynical and disconnected that it's a little cartoonish, and then it becomes, you know, she basically goes back to being a human being. That's a nice arc. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I will admit that it's not the most ambitious film in the world, but at the same time, there are so many little things that I just love in it. First of all, it has some amazing shots, not just of the countryside, you know, wide landscapes, but also just the way it's photographed, I really kind of fell in love with.
I wish there were a nice way. I wish there were a way to see it in HD.
I know, right? I keep hoping for a Blu-ray somewhere, but it hasn't happened yet.
It's pretty much, I think it's kind of forgotten by time. I had literally never heard of this movie.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it either won or was nominated for several Oscars.
Yeah, it came out also during the time when I was just starting to pay attention to this stuff. So it was like 98, right?
Something yeah,
like
yeah. Right around there.
I was just getting into movies seriously then.
Yeah, so. Well, weren't we all?
Right.
But the other thing is the woman who plays the old lady, Fernanda Montenegro. Mm-hmm. She's actually I'm not sure if she's still alive, but she was a very well-known actress in Brazil. But nobody knew about her here, and I thought she was amazing.
Yeah, it's a really good. That's a solid performance for sure.
Yeah, she's really good. And I always wonder about the kid that plays Josue, the boy, because there was apparently a similar film that came out a few years earlier, also Brazilian, and the kid basically turned into a rich little asshole and I think ended up getting murdered.
Well then.
Brazil's still a tough place.
All right.
So it's like I always wonder about the actors when they make films like this in third world countries. And that kind of gave the film additional life for me.
Well, this was made before Brazil kind of turned around. From what I understand, yeah. Like that country's doing a lot better now.
Yeah, from what I can tell as well. Right. Although who knows out in the countryside, we never see that.
Right. Yeah, right. Could be Gomorrah out there. But yeah. Well, anyway, I'm glad I saw it. Good movie.
Yeah. Oh, one little stupid footnote. That has the worst commentary track in the world.
Really?
The worst. Because they all speak English, except maybe the kid, but he's not in it. Or at least they think they speak English.
Yeah.
So Fernanda Montenegro's English is so bad and she's so old and rambly that you wait for her to finish a sentence and it doesn't end, and the sentence keeps going, and it stops working, and stops making sense, and you go, stop talking, and she doesn't. It's really amusingly frustrating for about 5 minutes, and then you have to turn it off because your head's going to explode.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Now, did not check that out. But sounds great.
Yeah. Well, right. I'm glad you liked the film, at least.
Yeah, I liked it. It was pleasant. Totally pleasant, good for like a Sunday afternoon. So I think that about wraps it up. I'm going to call this a success, and I think we should do it every year.
I agree. I really enjoyed this, despite Observe and Report.
Despite Observe and Report, but that's the gamble that you take, and it's good. Yep. It's good that we had a giant failure right out of the gate. Like, whoa, should not have recommended that movie to you. No, it's funny because you know. When you consume as much as we do, sometimes you just need a kick in the ass to watch something.
It is true, especially like old stuff that's been on the pile forever. Once it grows moss, you kind of don't want to touch it.
Yeah, right, exactly. And you're like, eh, I'm probably never going to get to that. But having that kick in the ass of like, all right, well, you have to talk about this, really gets you to watch it. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it. So that was great. Thanks for a great year.
You too. This is a lot of fun. I hope we can keep doing this for a couple more years at least.
Me too. All right. Well, everybody have a great holiday, and we will see you in 2012. Okay, that's our show and our year. Thanks to everybody for listening. It's been a great year. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, and while you're there, leave us a little rating or review. We'd appreciate it. And see you all in 2012.